Hello, everybody. Happy Tuesday. I'm Steve. I'm a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I'm going to be bringing you today's Arizona Daily Star. It is the 10th of June, 2025. I thought before we looked at the star this morning, we'd go ahead and have a look at what the National Weather Service has to say for the weather for the next few days. This is their synopsis. Dry and hot conditions across southeastern Arizona through the coming week, as high temperatures remain several degrees above normal. High temperatures peak this coming Sunday and Monday, when they will be 7 to 10 degrees above normal. So, keep cool, everyone. Now, we go ahead and turn to the star. This is the star for today. And it is the 10th of June, 2025, and thanks so much to the star for donating this subscription. Let's go to those front page stories. This is the title section of the front page stories. Downtown restaurant closes for summer, possibly for good. Next story, Pentagon sends Marines. The third story, Governor Hobbs turns tables, proposed law. And then the fourth of four stories on the front page, NIH scientists publish declaration criticizing cuts. Let's go ahead and move to that first front page story. Well, downtown Tucson may have lost one of its few upscale restaurants after Maynard's Kitchen and Bottle Shop in the historic depot on North Toole Avenue closed for the summer. Owners Richard and Shauna Osaran, that's O-S-E-R-A-N, Osaran, who also own Hotel Congress across the street at 311 East Congress Street, said they closed the business, that's Maynard's, on May 31st and will evaluate their options before deciding if they will reopen in the fall. We've taken a financial bath over there, Richard Osaran said Monday, as news of the closure and speculation of the restaurant's future started making its way around social media. We're not 100% that we won't reopen, but we're certainly considering that. Osaran said the couple has dumped several million dollars into that business since opening in 2008 and have been writing checks out of my savings, he said, to keep the business afloat post-pandemic. I'm talking big numbers, he said. There was no way that we could operate through the summer with the losses we were sustaining. Osaran said they notified Maynard's employees, mostly made up of about 15 part-timers, last month that the restaurant would close on May 31st for the summer months and offered several workers positions at Hotel Congress. The Osarans were the second ones to operate a restaurant in the historic depot at 400 North Toole Avenue, owned by the City of Tucson Department of Transportation. Central Bistro was there from 2006 to 2008 when it closed. The Osarans saw the opportunity to build up that east end of town where Congress and Toole meet the underpass for North 4th Avenue. Richard Osaran said he had spent tens of thousands of dollars renovating the space, including creating the market area. When it opened, Maynard's was downtown's only true upscale restaurant, with a chef-driven menu from founding chef Adam L. Busalini that included slow-braised beef short ribs, house-made gnocchi tossed with sweet figs, stone-baked pizza, and grilled apple bruschetta. The menu under Chef Roderick Ledesma, who has helmed the kitchen for about a year, includes a pan-roasted pan-roasted duck breast dressed with chitabin and Mexican sugar glaze, wild-caught black cod with coconut creamed corn and potatoes, and Ledesma's decadent date, or that's decadent take, on avocado toast, the foie-vocado toast, appetizer made with foie gras, ganache, and avocado mousse. If the restaurant reopens in the fall, Ledesma will continue as executive chef, Shana Osaran said. Ledesma could not be reached Monday for comment. The Osarans, however, say they haven't decided what they will do with Maynard's come fall. We're still looking at all of our options and all of our alternatives and trying to figure it out, said Richard Osaran, who admitted that at 80 years old, continuing to operate in this manner is a little too much for me. Osaran said he has spoken with some local chefs about coming in as chef operators to run the restaurant, and we've made certain offers to people that could come in and continue to operate the business, he said. Osaran said his lease with the city expires at the end of November. City officials on Monday said they were unaware that Maynard's had closed for the summer. All right, so that's a little bit of information about Maynard's. That sounds like a nice menu. I hope they can preserve Maynard's in the fall. Pentagon sends Marines is the next story for us this morning. And this is Dateline Los Angeles. The Pentagon deployed about 700 Marines to Los Angeles on Monday to help National Guard members respond to immigration protests, officials said, as California prepared to sue President Donald Trump over his use of Guard troops and demonstrators took to the city streets for a fourth day. The Marines were deployed from their base at 29 Palms in the Southern California desert to protect federal property and personnel, including federal immigration agents, U.S. Northern Command said in a statement. The Marines and National Guard troops are not expected to perform law enforcement duties, which are prohibited under the Posse Comitatus Act. That's the Posse Comitatus Act. Trump has not involved the and not invoked the Insurrection Act to allow them to do law enforcement. It is not clear if he intends to. Los Angeles Police Chief Jim McDonnell said in a statement Monday afternoon that he was confident in the police department's ability to handle large-scale demonstrations and that the Marines' arrival without coordinating with the police department presented a, quote, significant logistical and operational challenge, unquote, for them. California Attorney General Rob Bonta, that's B-O-N-T-A, Rob Bonta, announced the planned lawsuit over the use of National Guard troops by telling reporters that Trump had trampled, quote unquote, the state's sovereignty. We don't take lightly the president abusing his authority and unlawfully mobilizing California National Guard troops, Bonta said. He planned to seek a court order declaring Trump's use of the Guard unlawful and asking for a restraining order to halt the deployment. The arrival of the National Guard followed 2 days of protests that began Friday in downtown Los Angeles after federal immigration authorities arrested more than 40 people that day across the city. The smell of smoke hung in the air downtown Monday, a day after crowds blocked a major freeway and set self-driving cars on fire as police responded with tear gas, rubber bullets, and flashbang grenades. The law enforcement presence was heavy, with police cars from neighboring cities blocking the street in front of the federal detention facility that was a focus of the protests. The clashes unfolded over just a few square blocks in an immense city of some 4 million people, most of whom went about their normal business on peaceful streets. On Monday, thousands flooded the streets around City Hall for a union rally ahead of a hearing for arrested labor leader David Huerta, who was freed a few hours later on a $50,000 bond. Huerta's arrest on Friday while protesting immigration raids became a rallying cry for people angry over the administration's crackdown. He is the president, that's Huerta, is the president of the Service Employees International Union California, which represents thousands of the state's janitors, security officers, and other workers. Early protests Monday had a calm and even joyful atmosphere at times, with people dancing to live music and buoyed by Huerta's release. Protesters linked hands outside the downtown federal detention center where Huerta was being held, and at times sang in front of a line of police officers who unsuccessfully asked the people to move off the road and onto the sidewalk. Religious leaders joined the protesters, working with organizers at times to de-escalate moments of tension, chanting against a line of National Guard troops with Homeland Security officers behind them surrounding the federal buildings, ramped up in the afternoon as people yelled, "Free them all!" and "Next National Guard, go away!" Bonta, that's the fellow from California, Bonta accused Trump of fanning protesters' anger with his announcement of the deployment, saying he set off Sunday's clashes with law enforcement in downtown Los Angeles. "This was not inevitable," he said. Trump said Monday that the city would have been completely obliterated, quote unquote, if he had not deployed the Guard. Later, at a White House event, he added that the state leaders were afraid to do anything, quote unquote. So there you have a bit of information, folks, on the Pentagon sending Marines to the Los Angeles area to help law enforcement, but actually not conduct law enforcement duties. Governor Hobbs turns tables, proposed law. That's our next article this morning. And on the defensive after her veto last week, Governor Katie Hobbs is now proposing her own version of a law to decide who can't buy land in Arizona. The Democratic governor is asking the Republican-controlled legislature to ban any, quote, foreign adversary nation, unquote, or, quote, foreign adversary agent, unquote, from owning, purchasing, or otherwise having a substantial interest in real property in the state. The only exception would be if it is determined under federal law that the transaction does not pose a national security risk. In some ways, what Hobbs is proposing is similar to a bill originally written by Senate Majority Leader Jeanne Shamp. That's S-H-A-M-P, Jeanne Shamp. The plan by the surprise Arizona Republican applied to certain foreign principles, though it had exceptions for everything from residential property to land located at least 50 miles from any military installation. But by the time that bill reached Hobbs, it had been diluted by Scottsdale Republican Representative Alexander Culloden to apply only to the Chinese Communist Party. Hobbs, in rejecting that version last week, called it, quote, ineffective at counter-espionage, unquote, and said it does not protect our military assets. In writing her own plan, Hobbs is now going on the offensive against what has become a nation and national news story, as Republicans claimed she was putting U.S. security at risk with a veto. Shamp called Hobbs a, quote, total disgrace, unquote, and accused her of being an obstructionist against safeguarding our citizens from threats. Shamp specifically mentioned that Luke Air Force Base, where pilots are trained, is in her district. Fox News gave Carrie Lake, whom Hobbs defeated in 2022, a chance to call her, quote, disingenuous, unquote. And Republican Senate President Warren Peterson promised to seek an override of the veto later this month. There aren't the necessary two-thirds vote in each chamber to do that, and an override has not occurred here in more than four decades. But just the debate over whether Hobbs had endangered Arizonans would create more negative publicity for the governor, who hopes to win re-election next year in a state where Republicans outnumber Democrats. So that's a little bit of information on Governor Hobbs turns the tables and proposes her own law about this. And now we go to our last front page story. NIH scientists published declaration criticizing cuts. In his confirmation hearings to lead the National Institutes of Health, Jay Bhattacharya pledged his openness to views that might conflict with his own. Dissent, he said, is the very essence of science. That commitment is being put to the test. On Monday, scores of scientists at the agency sent their Trump-appointed leader a letter titled the Bethesda Declaration, challenging policies that undermine the NIH mission, waste public resources, and harm the health of Americans and people across the globe. It says, "We dissent. In a capital where insiders often insist on anonymity to say such things publicly, 92 NIH researchers, program directors, branch chiefs, and scientific review officers put their signatures on the letter and their careers on the line. Another 250 of their colleagues across the agency endorsed the declaration without using their names. The four-page letter addressed to Bhattacharya also went to Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and members of Congress who oversee the NIH. The White House defended its approach to federal research as follows. In recent years, Americans have lost confidence in our increasingly politicized healthcare and research apparatus that has been obsessed with DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, and COVID, which the majority of Americans moved on from years ago," spokesman Kush Desai said. "The Trump administration is focused on restoring the gold standard of science, not ideological activism, as the guiding principle of HHS, the NIH, and the CDC to finally address our chronic disease epidemic." The signers went public in the face of a culture of fear and suppression, they say President Donald Trump's administration has spread through the federal civil service. "We are compelled to speak up when our leadership prioritizes political momentum over human safety and faithful stewardship of public resources," the declaration says, named for the agency's headquarters location in Maryland. The Bethesda Declaration details upheaval in the world's premier public health research institution over the course of mere months. It addresses the termination of 2,100 research grants valued at more than $12 billion and some of the human costs that resulted, such as cutting off medication regimens to participants in clinical trials or leaving them with unmonitored device implants. In one case, an NIH-supported study of multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis in Haiti had to be stopped, ceasing antibiotic treatment mid-course for patients. In a number of cases, trials that were mostly completed were rendered useless without the money to finish and analyze the work, the letter says. Ending a $5 million research study when it is 80% complete does not save $1 million. It wastes $4 million, the letter said, among other things. So there you have it, NIH scientists published declaration criticizing cuts. And that, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, concludes our front page stories this morning. They were by titles: Downtown Restaurant Closes for Summer, Possibly for Good, Pentagon Sends Marines to L.A., and Governor Hobbs Turns the Tables, proposing her own law for keeping foreigners out, and NIH scientists publish declaration criticizing cuts. That's the front page. And if you're just joining us, welcome in. I'm Steve, a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I'm reading the Arizona Daily Star for today, June 10th, 2025. Let's move on now to the local news. And there are a few local news stories. This one is entitled, Opponents Can Challenge Copper Mine Plan. A U.S. district judge in Arizona has precluded the U.S. Forest Service from proceeding with the land exchange for the huge Oak Flat Copper Mine project until 60 days after the agency issues a required final environmental review. A U.S. district judge in Arizona has opened the door for the next round of legal wrangling as environmentalists and some Native Americans seek to stop the federal government from transferring land in Arizona for a massive copper mining project. Judge Dominic Lanza, in a ruling issued Monday, denied motions that sought to halt the transfer pending the outcome of the case. However, he did Lanza, preclude the U.S. Forest Service from proceeding with the land exchange until 60 days after the agency issues a required environmental review. Lanza said that would give the parties more time to analyze the environmental report and file amended complaints. He said that granting a preliminary injunction now would be premature, since the review will differ in some ways from the one that spurred the legal challenge 4 years ago. And so Judge Lanza said, it is unfortunate that the result of this order will be to force the parties to engage in another stressful, abbreviated round of briefing and litigation activity when the new review is issued. Acknowledging the unusual circumstances, was the judge. Attorneys for the federal government and the mining company agreed during a recent hearing to the 60-day delay. That time frame also is specified in the legislation that Congress passed and then President Barack Obama signed in 2014, authorizing the exchange. The group Apache Stronghold, the San Carlos Apache tribe, and others welcomed more time to fight for Oak Flat, an area they consider as holy. So that's the first story this morning in the local news. Opponents can challenge the copper mine plan. Let's move on. Gallego, this is Ruben Gallego, becomes crypto power player with stablecoin bill. Ruben Gallego, then a member of the U.S. House of Representatives, celebrated an election win for an Oregon Democrat with a social media post that alluded to her primary win over a well-supported opponent. Representative Andrea Salinas had slayed the crypto beast, quote-unquote, Gallego, a Democrat from Arizona, wrote in September 2022. He welcomed a Latina's win while he chaired the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. His word choice from 3 years ago might suggest a hostility to Sam Bankman-Fried, a cryptocurrency king whose political action committee spent millions to boost Salinas' opponent in her Democratic primary before making news for the collapse of his company. But these days, Gallego, now a freshman senator, often mentioned as a possible 2028 presidential contender, seems more open to the industry. Last year, groups aligned with the industry to spend $10 million supporting Gallego's Senate campaign. This year, Mark Andreessen, a billionaire venture capitalist who is one of the biggest advocates for cryptocurrencies, headlined a fundraiser for Gallego's affiliated campaign funds. It is part of the rapidly shifting politics of crypto. Gallego is part of a block of Democrats who have worked with Republicans on a bill that could become the first major legislation regulating stablecoins, a type of digital asset that generally tries to keep pace with the value of the U.S. dollar and is part of the cryptocurrency industry. He, that's Gallego, is the top-ranking Democrat on a Senate subcommittee overseeing digital currency issues and embodies a recent embrace of an industry that many Democrats and even President Donald Trump had once viewed with wariness. But Trump has dropped his reticence on the industry he once called a scam and has already pocketed billions from his family's own business interests in crypto. With Trump's support, the crypto industry is on the cusp of a major legislative breakthrough less than 3 years after a $1 trillion retreat in digital money known as the crypto winter. Gallego has delayed that triumph, at least for the moment. He said he and other Democrats working on the bill want to ensure the measure contains safeguards against money laundering and protects national security. So there you have a little bit on Gallego becoming a crypto power player with the stable coin bill, as it's called. And now our last local story. You get to have a say on the proposed new freeway. What's that about? Well, Tucson's will have the opportunity this month to give input on the future of a proposed new freeway in Pima County. The proposed Sonoran Corridor, which would be known as State Route 410, would connect Interstate 19 with Interstate 10 south of Tucson International Airport. According to the Arizona Department of Transportation, it would do the following: improve vehicle mobility and the transportation system, improve access to existing and future activity centers, and finally, reduce persistent traffic backups and road congestion. The Federal Highway Administration, on behalf of the Arizona Department of Transportation, that's ADOT, A-D-O-T, issued a notice of intent to prepare a Tier 2 environmental impact statement and a design concept report for the project. The Tier 2 study will develop and evaluate a range of 400-foot-wide freeway alignment alternatives within the 2,000-foot corridor, including a no-build option. It will also evaluate other design features and environmental impacts and mitigation. Officials will host two public meetings this month to provide information about the study and the project's purpose, and to seek input on the preliminary alternatives being considered. There will be an in-person meeting on Tuesday, June 17th. That's a week from today, Tuesday, June 17th, from 5:30 to 7 p.m. at the Suarita Unified School District Auditorium. That address, 350 West Suarita Road, and an online meeting via Zoom at tucne.ws/route on Wednesday, June 18th from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. So there's going to be a Zoom meeting the next day, the 18th, from 6 to 7 p.m. And that's going to be a Zoom meeting. And the URL for that is tucne.ws/route R-O-U-T-E. That's tucne.ws/route. That's the Zoom meeting, Wednesday, June 18th from 6 to 7 p.m. Outside of the two public meetings, there will be also a commenting period through July 18th. According to ADOT, Tucsonans can participate by taking the online survey at tucne.ws/corridor, C-O-R-R-I-D-O-R. That's tucne.ws/corridor. Calling a bilingual project information line at 855-712-8530. That's 855-712-8530. Or you can email the project team at sonorancorridor@a.gov. That's sonorancorridor, no spaces, at azdot.gov. Or finally, sending mail to ADOT Sonoran Corridor Study Team, care of Gordley Group, 2540 North Tucson Boulevard, Tucson, 85716. So that's a little information if you'd like to respond and have a say on the proposed new freeway. And that's the local news for this morning, the 2025 news of June 10th. So opponents can challenge copper mine plan. Gallego becomes crypto power player in stablecoin bill. And then have a say on proposed new freeway. Let's move ahead to the business section now of the Star this morning, the business section. And this involves Apple. Apple is hosting an annual showcase after stumbling out of the starting gate in big tech's pivotal race to capitalize on artificial intelligence. Apple tried to regain its footing Monday at its annual Worldwide Developers Conference. The pre-summer rite, which attracted thousands of developers from almost 60 countries to Apple's Silicon Valley headquarters, was more subdued than the feverish anticipation that surrounded the event during the previous 2 years. In 2023, Apple unveiled a mixed reality headset that has been little more than a niche product. And last year, the Worldwide Developers Conference, that's the WWDC they say here, trumpeted its first major foray into the AI craze with an array of new features highlighted by the promise of a smarter and more versatile version of its virtual assistant, Siri. That's S-I-R-I, Siri. Apple intended the planned Siri upgrade to herald its long-awaited attempt to become a major player in the AI craze after getting a late start in the phenomenon that so far is largely led by OpenAI, Google, Microsoft, and an array of cutting-edge startups. This work needed more time to reach our high-quality bar, Craig Federighi, Apple's top software executive, said Monday at the outset of the conference. The showcase unfolded amid nagging questions about whether Apple lost some of the mystique and innovative drive that turned it into a tech trendsetter during its nearly 50-year history. Instead of making a big splash as it did with the Vision Pro headset and its AI suite, Apple focused this year on an overhaul of its software that the company is billing as the most extensive overhaul of the iPhone's operating system in a decade. Federighi described the changes as Apple's attempt to make its software more compatible with the increasingly sophisticated computer chips that have been powering its products, while also making it easier to toggle between the iPhone, iPad, and Mac. Even though it might look like Apple is becoming a technological laggard, Forrester research analyst Thomas Husson contends the company still has ample time to catch up in an AI race that's more of a marathon than a sprint, and will force Apple to evolve its operating systems. Besides redesigning its software, Apple will switch to a method that automakers used to telegraph their latest car models by linking the new operating system to the year after they first arrive at dealerships. That means the next version of the iPhone operating system due out this autumn will be known as the iOS 26 instead of the iOS 19, as it would be under the previous naming approach that has been used since the device's 2007 debut. The iOS 26 upgrade is expected to be released in September, about the same time Apple traditionally rolls out the next iPhone models. So, there you have it, folks. That's a little bit of business, a little bit of Apple's business and Apple's thoughts on its AI future. Let's go ahead and move on now to the opinion section of the Star. And I'd like to remind our listeners, before I start the opinions, that these are the opinions of the writers of the opinion pieces. So let's go to the first one. Ironwood Forest marks 25th. That's its 25th anniversary, but it's at risk, according to the writer of this opinion piece. And the writer is Tom Hannigan. Tom Hannigan is a board president of Friends of Ironwood Forest. Let's see what Mr. Hannigan has for us this morning. Ironwood Forest marks the 25th anniversary, but it's at risk. Local elected officials have formally honored the now 25-year-old Ironwood Forest National Monument, even as the administration may be considering gutting its protections. To commemorate the occasion, our elected officials in Pima County, the city of Tucson, and the town of Marana all passed proclamations declaring Monday, June 9th, that's yesterday, as Ironwood Forest Day. The Friends of Ironwood Forest came together this past weekend to celebrate the anniversary, as well as push back against threats from the Trump administration to this spectacular place. Ironwood Forest, just northwest of Tucson, is a local natural treasure that is a prime example of largely undisturbed Sonoran Desert. The monument is a keystone piece of the county's Sonoran Desert Conservation Plan. Yet, Washington politicians have our prized refuge in their crosshairs. In April, the Washington Post reported that administration officials put Ironwood Forest on a short list of six monuments they're considering shrinking, eliminating, or otherwise weakening. Officials have not denied the report. The result of such an action would be to hand over our shared national public land to mining companies and other developers. It would prioritize mining over outdoor recreation, extraction over wildlife, the short-term profits of a few over the public good. A large copper mine exists next to the Ironwood Forest. Industrial mines like this one can permanently destroy a region's groundwater and wildlife habitat. Even exploratory mining does irreparable harm to these landscapes by fracturing habitat with roads and the use of heavy machinery. Ironwood Forest is set aside for the benefit of the public in perpetuity. For all these reasons and more, the people of this area have reaffirmed our commitment to its protection many times over the years, mostly recently, just last week, with the proclamations passed by Pima County, Tucson, and Marana. Thanks go to them for their recognition and support. So, I would like to ask, says Mr. Hannigan, the Trump administration, the following question. Has anyone given you the authority to trade Ironwood's wildlife, such as its spectacular and indigenous herd of desert bighorn sheep, for an expanded copper pit? Would you allow major mining companies to strip Ironwood Forest's largest mountains, which rise to 4,200 feet and include the Silver Bells, the Waterman, and the iconic Ragged Top? What would become of the keystone plant species, such as the largest remaining stand of ironwood trees, along with two species of Palo Verdes, velvet mesquite, and, of course, the saguaro cactus? Do you think the citizens of this region want to see mine tailings instead of their mountain viewscape? You can learn more about the monument at the Friends of Ironwood Forest website. The writer, Mr. Hannigan, says, we organize a variety of hikes, school field trips, community presentations, and volunteer work days during the cooler months. We also offer a free map for visitors wanting to know where they can go to visit or camp. Happy anniversary, Ironwood Forest. And that opinion piece was by Tom Hannigan. Tom Hannigan is board president of the Friends of Ironwood Forest, and the title was Ironwood Forest Marks Its 25th Anniversary and Is at Risk. Onward to our next opinion piece. Yesterday's tools will not work for tomorrow's wars is the title of this opinion piece by Howard Weiss. Howard Weiss has owned an advertising agency in Tucson for over 50 years and spends most of his time developing regenerative seawater-based aquaculture and agriculture systems. That's Howard Weiss. Yesterday's tools won't work for tomorrow's wars. As a former U.S. Air Force nuclear missile combat crew commander who has called Tucson home for six decades, I deeply appreciate what Raytheon brings to our community. The company's 12,000 high-paying jobs have been an economic cornerstone for Tucson and Pima County. I also understand the critical importance of maintaining strong defense capabilities. However, Saturday's Star coverage of Raytheon's $1.1 million, that's billion dollar, $1.1 billion AIM -9X contract, that's the AIM-9X contract, compels me to voice serious concerns about the Pentagon's strategic direction. This massive investment, the largest production contract to date for the program, will produce 2,500 missiles annually at approximately $440,000 per missile. With the AIM-9X Sidewinder, and while the AIM-9X Sidewinder is undoubtedly a sophisticated weapon, we must ask ourselves the following. Is this the smartest allocation of our defense dollars when facing 21st century threats? Modern warfare, that's modern warfare, has fundamentally changed. In Ukraine, drones costing as little as $400 are neutralizing sophisticated Russian equipment worth thousands of times more. China's DJI Mavic 3, used by both sides, costs about $2,000, meaning you could purchase $55,000 for the price of a single F-35 jet fighter. This cost disparity isn't just about numbers. It represents a fundamental shift in military doctrine. Russian Shahed drones, that's Shahed, S-H-A-H-E-D, Shahed drones, estimated at $35,000 each, $35,000 each, retain what experts call a cruel attritional logic against traditional defense systems. The advent of cheap commercial drones has sharply tilted cost asymmetry toward offense. As documented in Raj M. Shah's compelling book, Unit X, How the Pentagon and Silicon Valley Are Transforming the Art of War, the Defense Department has consistently failed to embrace the technological revolution reshaping modern conflict. Shah chronicles how a small group of military innovators fought bureaucratic resistance to integrate cutting-edge commercial technologies into defense systems. The mathematical reality is sobering. For the cost of this single AIM-9X contract, we could potentially field hundreds of thousands of advanced drones, develop revolutionary AI-enabled defense systems, or accelerate hypersonic weapons programs. Instead, we're doubling down on a paradigm where each engagement costs more than most Americans' homes. This isn't about abandoning proven capabilities or undermining Raytheon's work. It's about achieving the right balance between current readiness and preparing for future conflicts. We need a defense strategy that embraces technological disruption. The Pentagon must shift from its traditional focus on exquisite, expensive systems toward proliferated, adaptive technologies. Tucson's defense community, including Raytheon, should lead this transformation rather than resist it. Our region has the talent, infrastructure, and innovation ecosystem to become America's center for the next generation defense technologies. But this requires acknowledging that the future of warfare looks very different from the past. America's military superiority depends not on perfecting yesterday's solutions, but on embracing tomorrow's possibilities. We can honor that and our community's economic interests and our nation's security, but only if we change course before it's too late. And that opinion piece was by Howard Weiss. He has owned an advertising agency in Tucson for over 50 years and spends most of his time now developing regenerative seawater-based aquaculture and agriculture systems, but he's a former U.S. Air Force nuclear missile combat crew commander in his working life. That's yesterday's tools won't work for tomorrow's wars. Let's move on to our next opinion piece this morning. And it is, Trump's call out of guard is opposite of LBJ's. And this is our last opinion piece this morning. And this opinion piece is written by Michael A. Chiok. And he is a retired newsman. He lives in Tucson. America is for Americans and Americans only, so quoted Stephen Miller, the racist, xenophobic presidential aide at a 2024 hate-filled campaign rally in the center of the immigrant universe, New York City. His comment set the tone for the president's escalating obsession with immigrants of color. Can Miller's declaration withstand the test of a few questions? Why wasn't the president's white mother, a Scottish immigrant, deported as a non-American? She was a lawbreaker, stating for the 1940 census she was a U.S. citizen, but she wasn't until 1942. Scotland's newspaper, The National, reported. Falsifying information on a U.S. census form is a crime. Should Miller's white great-grandparents, that's Stephen Miller's white great-grandparents, immigrants who fled Tsarist Russia's pogroms, have been deported as non-Americans? They likely did not show me your papers at Ellis Island among millions of white Europeans welcomed without question in the early 1900s. Why wasn't the president's white wife, an immigrant from Slovenia, deported as a non-American? She broke the law before she was married to the president, taking U.S. modeling jobs in 1996. Her visa at the time forbade her from working, the Associated Press reported. Why wasn't the president's ex-friend, a white South African billionaire, who fled his homeland to avoid military service, deported as a non-American? He was here on a student visa and went to work instead of school, violating immigration law, CNN reported. Should the 98.4% of us who are descended from immigrants after the year 1492 be deported, leaving the land to the descendants of roughly 10 million people who were here before the 19th century, before the 15th century, rather? What's the point of these questions, you ask? This land, before it was and since it has been the United States, was, is, and always will be multicultural, multiracial, multi-ethnic, despite the current racist leadership's efforts to make it white-only. Pre-Columbian inhabitants, non-white people who were multicultural and multi-ethnic, that is, thrived for millennia before this was America. They lived and governed by natural law, respecting the land and the elements, putting community above self and compassionately, with tragic naivete, welcoming white people who arrived from afar. Leaders of the dominant white culture, having long ago conquered the original inhabitants, their descendants, and other non-white people, now want to rid U.S. society of as many people of color as possible via mass deportations. To them, America is for white people, and white people only. Furthering that idea, the white immigrant descendant president has dispatched troops to quell what he called rebellion. He claims and aims to suppress people who are calling him out for his overt racism in deporting immigrants of color. Today's scenario is the opposite of 60 years ago when President Lyndon Johnson sent troops to segregated Alabama to enforce civil rights laws on behalf of black people, acknowledging the country's diversity and its original declaration that all people are created equal. We asked the president, paraphrasing others, specifically, "Have you no shame? Have you no compassion? Have you no Judeo-Christian morals?" The answers are all yes. This president, a white descendant of immigrants, is shameless, non-compassionate, and amoral. And that opinion piece this morning was by Michael A. Chiak, and he's a retired newsman and lives in Arizona, and the title of his piece was "Trump's Call Out of Guard is the Opposite of LBJ's." So those are the opinion pieces this morning, folks, and their titles were, just to review, "Ironwood Forest Marks the 25th Anniversary but it's at Risk," "Yesterday's Tools Won't Work for Tomorrow's Wars," and "Trump's Call Out of Guard, the National Guard specifically, is opposite of LBJ's." Now, let's go ahead, and since Tucson is such a giving community, let's end our broadcast this morning, I think, with a nice note on Tucson giving. And there are several ways to celebrate Juneteenth locally. That's June 19th. And there are a variety of events. Juneteenth, for those who need a reminder, is a movement, not a moment. "We are making this much more than a festival," said Starks, president of the nonprofit Tucson Juneteenth Festival Incorporated. That's Larry Starks. "It's not just a black event. It's about black people, but we include everyone. This is a community-oriented event that is very welcoming to everyone because we know that Southern Arizona and Tucson are the best we can be when we all come together." Juneteenth originally started in Galveston, Texas, to commemorate June 19, 1865, which was the date that enslaved people in that state were informed of their freedom. It is the oldest known celebration of the end of slavery in the United States, and 2025 marks the 55th year of the Juneteenth Festival in Tucson. We have to teach people about history. You can deny history and you can ignore it, but you can't replace it. What has happened, and we have moved forward from that. This is the celebration of community, about the legacy of a group of people who were held hostage for a long time, and they came out and came back to represent their community and where they came from. It is a great time for us to educate people about the importance of Juneteenth, Larry Starks said. He joined the festival board of directors in 2016 to honor the memory of his brother, Bernie Starks, who led the Tucson Festival for more than 20 years. The local festival was originally founded as a day of entertainment and celebration in the A Mountain neighborhood of in the A Mountain neighborhood by Bobby Dixon, Terry Wayne Dixon, Morris Doty, and Robert Foley. Tucson native Jack Anderson, 74, a musician known as OG, that's capital O, capital G, Jackie Blue, BLU, was one of the original organizers and remains the entertainment coordinator today. Anderson said that as an 18-year-old who loved guitar and keyboard, he knew very little about the history of African Americans. His family had relocated to Tucson from Texas before he was born, and learning about Juneteenth was very impactful. He was also grateful for the opportunities the Tucson Festival provided for young people like himself to showcase their music, art, and heritage during what he described as the insane 60s. So Juneteenth it is. If you're interested in Juneteenth, then you should definitely go. Let's see if we can figure that information out for you. Juneteenth events is where it is. Tucson Juneteenth Festival is 5 to 10 p.m. Saturday, June 14th. That's this Saturday, June 14th, 5 to 10 p.m. at the Keno Sports Complex, which is 2500 East Ajo Way. It's free. This family-friendly event includes live entertainment, food trucks, pop-up tents, ready-made treats, a car show featuring low riders, and a 5 p.m. walk-in led by Divine Nine, the NAACP, Buffalo Soldiers, Pima Lodge No. 10 Masons, Warriors for Justice, and Governor Katie Hobbs. Volunteers are needed. So, if you're interested, go to visit TucsonJune19.org. That's TucsonJune19, all connected, no spaces, .org for more information or to donate. Well, that's it, folks. That's it for me this morning. I hope that you have a great day. Try to stay cool out there. And thanks so much for the privilege of your time. I'm wishing you the best of goodbyes.